Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 180 of The Morning After. I am your host, Sari Kamen. I am here in studio with my guest, Brian Leventhal. He is the owner of Brooklyn Winery in Williamsburg and the new BKW by Brooklyn Winery, which is a new restaurant in Crown Heights. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great as well.
Oh, good. I'm so happy you're here. You brought some delicious Blanc de Blanc.
Yes,
from Brooklyn Winery, which is what I recall 100% Chardonnay.
100% Chardonnay, our first sparkling wine, straight from the Finger Lakes.
From the Finger Lakes.
Upstate New York.
Nice. And some Gewürztraminer as well.
Also from the Finger Lakes.
Very nice. Well, before we get into that, I have some food news, if you wouldn't mind me sharing with the group.
Let's do it.
Okay, cool. Our first story comes out of Canada, and I have to warn you, it's a little bit upsetting.
Let's hear.
Okay. The first poo-themed dessert cafe.
That's what we're up
is
to
set
right
to
now.
Open in Canada. Have you heard about this? Oh, exactly. This has been big news.
So how do they theme it poo?
It's actually meant to look like a bathroom. Apparently, like, all the customers sit on...
Oh, so it's not just what the food looks like.
Right.
It's also the actual aesthetics of the restaurant.
Although the food does look like poo.
So everything's brown or...
Everything is brown.
Green, it's a orange.
She's trying to make poop cute. That's a quote from Ms. Nugent, the woman who is opening this place. She said she first discovered the concept on a visit when she was visiting her mother in Taiwan a few years ago. And she saw a toilet-themed restaurant and she just loved it. As you do.
So when you're sitting down, is there really like a hole that like is there on your chair?
All I know is it says diners will sit on fake toilets and they will eat their food out of lavatory and urinal shaped dishes.
Yeah. That's not the first thing I want to think about when I'm eating.
It's actually the last thing, but weirdly enough, similarly themed restaurants have actually opened already in Russia, in South Korea, the Philippines, China, Japan, and Indonesia.
So,
it's so strange.
Some of those countries are, you know.
Yeah. The restaurant that inspired her is called Modern Toilet. Cute name. That restaurant has shower heads on the walls, plunger-shaped lampshades, and a tiled floor, and diners can relax in their toilet-style seats with poo-shaped cushions. What is wrong with you people? Like, can someone call in and explain this to me right now?
I hate everything about this.
This is disgusting. This is weird. This is like a weird fetish that I don't want to know exists.
I'm hoping she used her own money and no one else thought this was a great idea and gave her money towards this
idea. Does Justin Trudeau know about this? He has to make this stop.
Yeah, I mean, but maybe what they're going for is now there's a radio show in Brooklyn talking about this. So now it's going to be, you know, you got to distinguish yourself some way these days.
That's true. That's true. It is a unique concept that I want nothing to do with. Never speak of this again, ever. All right, moving on. This one comes out of Orlando. There was a man who was leaving a 7-Eleven, and the cops pulled him over because they suspected something suspicious because he went into the 7-Eleven, he didn't buy anything, and he left with an employee in his car. So the cops were like, that seems weird. So they pulled him over, they opened his car, and they saw all these white flakes. And the cop was like, oh, that's crystal meth. Because I know, because I'm a cop. They arrested him, and the guy was like, that's not crystal meth, that's my, like, donut flake. And I think they booked him, or like they put him in jail. And then after they sent the meth flakes to the lab, it came back positive for Krispy Kreme.
So was he kidnapping an employee or just having like a rendezvous donut break?
Donut break.
Huh.
And the driver apparently let the cops search the car, and the lady cop found more chunks, which two roadside tests showed to be crystal meth.
Oh, there was crystal meth as well.
There was not.
Oh, there wasn't.
There was not. It was like 100% Krispy Kreme. But a roadside test showed, I guess it's like very scientific something. It turned out all to be like Lays from a donut. They tried to say it was crack cocaine or crystal meth, but it was
interesting
Krispy Kreme.
That chunks of Krispy Kreme donut look like crystal meth. And that might say something about Krispy Kreme donuts.
It might say something. I don't know what it says specifically.
Yeah, I can go in either direction.
I could speculate, but I think I'm not. I'm just going to move on. So this is one that I'm really curious to hear what you have to say about this, Brian. There's a group of wine terrorists in France. Have you heard about this? They call themselves Le Crave.
What do they do?
Well, apparently they go around and vandalize wine that's not from France. Because they feel so strongly that France should be loyal to French-made wine that they're sort of like have like a thug mentality about them and vandalize wine from Spain or other places and destroy it. And like their latest crime, their latest rampage occurred in a place called Sète, which is a port in the south of France. So a group of these people, they're self-described wine terrorists. They managed to break into a distributor there named Biron. And they dumped an estimated 10,000 gallons of red wine into the streets.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Is that sad?
That's
Is that
really
like
sad.
Wine flowing in the streets?
It's also, I thought, we're at a point where people are understanding that great wine can be made in a variety of different places. And not just in France. So that's unfortunate.
Yeah. It's just, it's like, that's a lot of wine wasted. But I kind of like the image of, like, walking around with, like, wine flowing in the streets.
Yeah. I'm curious what wine they dumped, because there is...
I don't know. Apparently, it was according to them, it was Biron's punishment for importing cheap bulk wine from Spanish producers.
So they're trying to make...
Who are their mortal enemies.
They're making a statement.
Oh, they sure are.
So
yeah, and earlier this year, they hijacked 5 tankers of Spanish wine at the border to protest the unfair advantage that Riojas and La Manchas have in France.
So they're trying to basically... A lot of producers will try to kind of hide cheaper wine within their region, and it cheapens the brand of that region. And wine labeling laws are all over the map, and you don't always have to say what's in your wine. So, you know, when they probably found there's some wineries in this region that is bringing in cheaper Spanish wine, adding it was probably just enough of their French wine, but they still call it all made in France. And that is actually a big issue because it kind of blindsides the consumer.
Huh. So do you support the actions of Le Crave?
I don't support their actions, but I do support their philosophy in trying to... Because what they're really doing is they're trying to protect the consumer if you look at kind of the end case, because, you know, not everyone knows what they're buying in the bottle. And for those French producers in that region that are trying to stay true, they may have a higher cost of production and sell their wines a lot off of the region being printed on the label. Then when there's another winery that might be next door to them that is going to produce an inferior wine for a cheaper price point, it's not fair to the winery that's doing it legitimately.
Huh. Okay. That's interesting. So I guess their cause is noble, but we still feel sad that there's 10,000 gallons of wine running in the street.
I think that's a fair way of assessing it.
Okay. Fair enough. Good to know. We are going to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk more with Brian Leventhal.
And this one is called Torchlight by Rectech. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Peter Kim, the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. We're a nonprofit founded by Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues here on the Heritage Radio Network, and we want to take people on a learning adventure through the world of food. We just opened MOFAD Lab, our gallery space at 62 Bayard Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we are currently showing Flavor, Making It and Faking It. Flavor features some very cool sensory interaction. Flavor tablets deliver tastings of vanilla and umami, and the Willy Wonka-inspired smell synth lets you compose over 500,000 different flavors. So come on by and visit MOFAD Lab. We're open 5 days a week, and tickets are $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Learn more about the Museum of Food and Drink at MOFAD.org.
And we're back. You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Sarah Kamen, and I'm here in studio with my guest today, Brian Leventhal. Hey, Brian.
Hello.
Welcome back from the break.
Good to be here.
Yeah. So you have a lot of exciting things going on, and that's why you're here today.
Sweet.
You have a brand new restaurant.
We do. Because I was on the show, a few years ago now?
Yeah, like 2 years ago.
This was all probably just in the works and not able to be spoken about.
You did not mention it.
I did not
see it coming.
I was not allowed to.
All
it was
right.
Also the infancy of the idea, probably, and now we finally have gotten the restaurant open.
So the restaurant is called BKW, as in Brooklyn Winery.
Correct. We look at it as kind of like an offshoot of the winery in Williamsburg, and we wanted it to kind of flow from our brand here.
So what are kind of like the main differences between the restaurant and Brooklyn Winery, and then what are also like the similarities? Like, how are they linked?
Sure. So we tried to open a real, like, legitimate full-service restaurant. And at BKW, there is a full dinner menu, full kitchen that you can come in and have an actual real dining experience. There's also a large bar where you can have just a glass of wine, nibble on some cheese as well. So big difference between Brooklyn Winery and the restaurant, BKW. Brooklyn Winery has a wine bar, we call it, which isn't always open every day of the week either, because we have a lot of large-scale events that sometimes close the wine bar down. And the wine bar at Brooklyn Winery has a smaller, small share plate menu. Food is still great, but it's not. We don't have the same kitchen capabilities there that we do at the restaurant. So the restaurant's going to be open 7 days a week. Actually, we're at 6 days right now, Tuesday through Sunday. We'll eventually get Monday open. And the full menu, that's a big difference. A big similarity is the wine. So all the wine at the two restaurants is made by Brooklyn Winery. And there are a few wines that we do serve at the restaurant that are not at the winery. So it makes gives you a little reason to go over there and try a few
things. Can you tell us what those wines are?
Sure. We have a really lovely Malbec with grapes sourced from a region called Sassoon Valley, which is borders right on Napa Valley in California. Gorgeous, nice fruit-forward Malbec. And we also have a Cabernet Franc, which is a red wine with grapes from the Finger Lakes. It's really, really lovely. Another cool thing about the restaurant is we have a bottle list there. We don't have a bottle list at the winery. And the bottle list encompasses old vintages of Brooklyn Winery wines that are not released anymore. So you can actually have the first wine we ever made at Brooklyn Winery, where we just saved a handful of bottles and put them kind of away in storage. And we created this really cool list of about 20 wines that we brought back a few bottles of each that you can order and have at the restaurant.
So they're just kind of there until they run out?
They're there till they run out.
What is the first wine ever created by Brooklyn Winery?
The first wine, and it's a great story, we bring all our grapes in. We truck them in from various regions. And the first wine is a Chardonnay. It's we call it Batch 001 Chardonnay. It's the first wine we ever made. It came from the Finger Lakes. And we didn't really know how, like, the trucking would work with grapes. And we thought the grapes were coming in a certain day. And we were waiting at the winery. And, like, we waited till like 4 a.m. for the grapes to arrive, not realizing that it was on a refrigerated truck and the truck driver was actually stopping like midway between the Finger Lakes and the city to just sleep and was going to drop them off first thing in the morning. And we had no idea how like the logistics worked. And we waited till like 4 a.m. so anxious for our first grapes to arrive. And then they ended up coming the next day.
Did you guys just like pass out at the winery?
Yeah, we were running on fumes at that point anyway.
Oh, like waiting up for Christmas and then Santa doesn't come.
Exactly.
it's
a really special wine. It's actually extreme. 2010 was an amazing vintage. That was our first year in New York State. It's so good. Like, we have a few that we're selling there, but we'll, every now and then we open one up like on a special occasion, and it's awesome.
Very cool. So tell me a little bit about like the concept behind the food. And I imagine, you know, when you create a menu for a restaurant where wine is so important in such, I don't know if, I almost think of it as like Brooklyn Winery, like wine comes first and then the food, or what the philosophy was like behind this restaurant. But how did you think about the wine when you were creating the menu?
So that's a really good question. And that's actually the approach we initially thought we were going to take. Let's build food around the wine. It's actually a really challenging thing to do. Yeah. It's hard to like, oh, like, here we have this Cab Sauv, for example. Can we create a dish that's going to work perfectly with this Cab Sauv? And, like, there's, like, kind of directions you can go in and like, yeah, steak probably goes with Cab, and you can think that way. But to have, like, a really perfect pairing, there's actually, it's very challenging to craft the dish in that way. So we ended up taking a different approach. And let's develop an amazing menu of food that also can change on a constant basis. And we have enough versatility in our wines from the different grapes and styles that our wines, as long as we're making foods that have kind of the core elements that are going to pair well with wines, we can actually pair the wines well after we create the food menu. And we took that approach, and it actually... then there's several wines that can work with each dish, and it actually worked a lot better that way.
Is that something that's written on the menu, or is it sort of built into the service to help kind of guide you?
Yeah, we also took the approach, should we like write suggested pairing or should we not? These were a lot of big discussions as we were thinking through this. We actually took the stance to not write suggested pairings. There's a lot of different ways the wines can go, and it allows the servers to have that type of table talk experience with the guests. We do serve a lot of flights there, so you're able to try a lot of different wines with the food items that you're getting.
Do you think you need to have kind of an understanding or like a background in wine when you sit down at BKW and like you approach the menu? Do you feel like you have to be informed to a certain extent?
I don't think so. And this has always been our approach with the wine. If you like a wine, it's a good wine. That's really the bottom line. We try to really not make it intimidating. All of our wine is named by the varietal. So it starts to get people to learn by like, oh, a Riesling is kind of has these general characteristics, or Chardonnay has these characteristics. And we will guide the customer through the process of helping to choose what wines to drink. A fun thing that we're doing there, if you sit down and dine in the dining room, we kind of took the concept of the amuse-bouche, where like the chef will bring out his, you know, little one bite thing to serve. We've kind of turned that on its head, and we did an amuse-bouche of wine. So anyone that sits down in the dining room will, without asking, will be served a small taste of our choice of wine for the day.
Oh, and everyone in the restaurant will get the same one for the day. It's
yes.
Not like different for every person.
Correct, but we might change it on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. So if you come back, you'll get something different. And the idea here is we'll a lot of times pick wines that maybe aren't the ones that are the most popular wines, but it's something that you may not want to have committed an entire glass of or ordering a full glass of, but you're able to try like a few sips of. And it can start to change people's perceptions on wine and get them to trial new things without having to commit to purchasing it.
I love that idea. And it could also potentially get something on the list moving that, you know, well, people want
that is kind of an underlying thing we can
not
do
to
is
blow up your secret.
There's other reasons to do it as well. But what we do see is like what's cool is you actually look at some of the data, and if we offer like Gewürztraminer, which is a, you know, a wine that I love and is one of my fiance's favorite wine, but it's a hard wine to pronounce. Actually, people don't order it as much because I think they're intimidated by what it sounds like.
Is that true?
I guess I totally think so.
Yeah.
Then we offer a small taste of it, and we're like, oh my God, this is amazing. I would never have thought to order this.
I never knew how to say it.
And then people will order a glass of it after they receive the taste of it.
They feel so empowered.
Yes, exactly.
Really
and then
funny.
You know what? Now they're not intimidated anymore. They can go to a different restaurant. They can see Gewürztraminer on the menu. It's like, you know what? I had an awesome awesome diversity.
Brian, you are changing lives. So you kind of mentioned a few minutes ago during the break that running a restaurant is really different than running a winery. Talk about that.
Well, the winery in Williamsburg, for those that haven't been there, it serves... there obviously is the core manufacturing component, which kind of is its own world, and we have a team that focuses on the production and the wine side. But that space has really morphed into like a really cool event venue with the winery as the backdrop. We do a lot of weddings, corporate functions, all different types of events. And the nice thing about running events is everything is known. You know how many people are going to come in, you know what food they're getting, you know how to prep and prepare properly, and you have a pretty standardized service that's going to happen. Everything's on a timeline. There's really very few surprises that happen with events, and we've gotten very good at that. A restaurant is very different. The service flow in a restaurant, you can kind of make assumptions like, okay, we have so many reservations on the book. We have an idea of how many people are going to come in today. We kind of know from past experience, this is kind of the flow of what people are going to be ordering. But there's so much uncertainty with service in terms of the kitchen getting hit. Everything's made to order, so they're getting hit with, they could have 10 orders of the same dish all at once, or it could be spread out. Getting everyone served in a timely manner, it's very interesting. It's very different for us.
Yeah. Are there things you kind of anticipated at the beginning with the restaurant that have completely changed, or just, you know, you discovered they didn't work at all, or just have morphed since the time that you guys have opened?
I mean, we launched an initial menu. I come from more of like a consulting. I have a little bit more of a corporate background. So like I love numbers. And when you run everything through like a point of sale POS machine, the amount of data you collect is unbelievable, which I love. So we started looking at dishes and what people are ordering and types of checks. And, we went out with an initial menu, but you very quickly see things that are working, things that aren't working. We've only been open for less than 2 months now, and there's been several dishes that have been cycled off the menu that weren't ordered as frequently, and we're constantly wanting to evolve the menu. Just with the full service flow, we have a kitchen. The kitchen's in the basement, so you have to have food run upstairs, up and down and up and down. Understanding like the runners, it's really interesting because if they're stationed downstairs, they're not helping out upstairs with helping bus dishes and other things. But if they're upstairs, they may not know when food is ready to be brought back upstairs, when the kitchen has it ready. So it's kind of like what their role ended up being, where they're supposed to be stationed, when you need two people on the roll. So a lot of this we're kind of learning as we go.
Yeah. I read that there's a micro winery.
Yes.
What does that mean?
So, by law, and we don't need to dive into this unless you're super interested, in order for me to open a restaurant having already opened a winery, legally by law, I can't open a restaurant unless it also has a winery part of it.
That's a really, really weird law.
New York State Liquor Authority, it's a whole... three-tier liquor system, blah, blah, blah. But
that's one of the most random laws I've ever heard.
You're not allowed. Yeah. Anyway, it's crazy laws, but instead of looking at it as a negative, we tried to look at it as an opportunity.
There you go.
So the micro winery, just the way the space set up, it isn't public facing, but it is in the basement area where the kitchen is. And we have like a dedicated space. And we're going to make at least 50 gallons of wine, just to put that in perspective. That's 50 gallons is, no, more than 50 gallons. What is it? It's at least a few, we're going to make a few hundred bottles of wine down there. And it gives our winemaker the chance to do some like super like experimental stuff. And it's going to be made downstairs. And this stuff will only be served at the restaurant. So we're not even going to bring it back to the winery. And we'll be able to make a few things throughout the year and bring in cool different things.
So it's going to be like his like man cave where he can like just get weird.
Totally. He's gonna have, yeah.
He must be so psyched.
Yeah, so we're gonna start that this fall. I actually have not heard yet what the first thing we're gonna make is, but I know like there's no reason not to be like super fun with it and do something crazy.
I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, and he has it like all in his head, and like he's pumped about
it. This is Connor, right?
Connor McCormick. Yeah, he's been with us since day one. Amazing winemaker.
Yeah, and he hailed from California.
He grew up in San Jose. Worked. He has a great story because he was a music major. He was actually in touring bands when he was like in high school and college, like toured around the world and like heavy metal bands and all kinds of crazy stuff. Never thought he was going to get into wine. Graduated college, and he took like just a summer internship working at a vineyard just to like make some money. Fell in love with like growing grapes and the whole process. Eventually wanted to learn how wine got made, moved into the winery, and kind of started from the ground up and just got a pure passion for it. He ended up going back to school to get all the wine like chemistry knowledge afterwards. A lot of people start there and then actually learn how to make it. He actually filled in those gaps. He's like, I know how to make it, but I want to know why this happens. So he went to school to learn the why, and then he was out there for a while and looked at joining us as a great opportunity to start something from the ground up.
Yeah, and I know that I don't know what the percentage is, like some of your wines are from California, or some of the grapes are made or grown in California, and then some of them are from Finger Lakes or other upstate areas.
Long Island as well.
Like I feel like people on the East Coast often have sort of like preconceptions about California wine. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about, like, misconceptions maybe that New Yorkers or other East Coast people might have about California wines? And how do you kind of, like, address that or debunk the myths?
So, you know, California is a hotter region. So when you have a region that's very hot, it's going to lend itself to how the grapes get grown. So just winemaking 101 right now on how grapes go. So more heat, the grapes are going to get riper. So the hotter it is, the riper the grapes are going to get. There's going to be more sugar content in those grapes more quickly. New York, Finger Lakes, total opposite, right? Much cooler region. The sugar content never reaches the same, even remotely near the level as California grapes do. So now you start with grapes that are really high in sugar. And that sugar directly converts into alcohol when you're making wine. So the process of fermentation is the conversion of sugar to alcohol. When you start with a lot of sugar, you're going to end up having a wine with higher alcohol. It's also going to add more body. Alcohol also adds body to a wine. And so when you're starting with fruit that's already like grown in a certain way, it just makes sense to have wines that are in that type of style. So California wines tend to be higher in alcohol, higher in kind of just big, bold, like also intense ripe fruit leads to more fruity flavors, just more intense flavors in general. But that can be good if you know kind of how to rein that in a little bit. If you kind of let it go out of control, it isn't always a positive thing. Higher alcohol doesn't mean a better wine. You can taste that burning feeling in your throat. A lot of California wineries have become known for is one way they combat some of that alcohol and big fruit flavors is let's just put lots of oak flavors on this as well. And like they found that they kind of mesh well. So you find these really, really oaky California wines, which also have started to get a little bit bad rap because what people sometimes want is I want to taste the grapes. I want to taste what those grapes actually taste like. And when you're dumping this oak on it and alcohol, it's actually hard to taste what those grapes truly taste like.
I just think you should eat more cheese.
Well, you can do that too.
That's my advice.
For us, we work really closely with the grower of those grapes, and we make sure that the grapes get picked at a point where things aren't going to get crazily out of control. We like letting people taste the fruit. We don't put like crazy new oak flavors on the wine. We use a lot of barrels that have been used before, which will not have as strong of an oak flavor, and letting that fruit kind of speak for itself.
You know what my favorite Brooklyn Winery wine is?
What's that?
The Zinfandel. And the Abigail Restermeiner, too.
So the
Zinfandel.
The Zinfandel is an example of where we're like, California has made Zin famous. Mm-hmm. So the best Zins in the world are all made in California. It's also a wine that California has made really boring. So Zin is one of those grapes that there's great Zins and there's horrible Zins.
You guys have a great Zin.
And it's a very tricky wine to make. You got to treat it carefully.
I love it. So tell me, are there some just absolute favorites at this point on the menu at BKW? What are the big standouts?
Food or wine are we talking about?
I'm talking about food.
Food. Yeah, so I've obviously eaten there a lot, and I try to get different things when I go. So we have, small plate-wise, we have a really nice chilled melon soup, like for the summer, is awesome.
I bet that's good with the Gewürztraminer.
Yeah, it's really good with the Gewürztraminer. We have also...
I feel like this has just turned into a drinking game. Like, every time someone says Gewürztraminer, we should drink the Gewürztraminer.
We should pour ourselves some.
We've said it so many times.
We do have a bottle of it right
really
in front of us.
It's really fun to say. I hope we're empowering everybody out there.
We also have this, like, bacon dish. Like, this thick slab
this,
cut
like, bacon dish.
Because, like, who doesn't want to eat bacon? I love bacon.
I hear it's popular. In Brooklyn, specifically.
Larger plates.
Well, tell us about the bacon dish.
Thick bacon, like charred broccoli. It's really good.
It's like all you need to know is bacon.
Yeah. My favorite large is actually our chicken dish, which is we do this beautifully like the most moist chicken breast I've ever had, sliced up. But then since we buy full chickens, we wanted something to do with all of the dark meat. So also on the plate is this awesome like chicken pot pie that comes with the chicken breast, which uses the dark meat incorporated into that.
Ah,
and then there's
chicken
like sauteed greens and like it's just really comforting.
Yum.
Nice dish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I imagine you'll be able to keep that on the menu for a long time.
That will be like one of the stay true ones. And then some desserts, amazing donuts, because donuts are very in right now. But a cool, like, innovative dessert that we came up with is a play on this famous, like, Spanish drink called Calimocho, which Calimocho is half red wine, half, like, cola. And this is drank, like, all over Spain. And we decided to do a Calimocho float, where we have, actually, our Zinfandel with cola. And then we do a scoop of this, like, really rich mascarpone gelato. And it's pretty awesome.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
I can definitely, like, the Coke and wine thing I never really got. But you add the ice cream and it all makes
sense. I wouldn't have it on its own, but when you add the ice cream to
it.
Yeah,
that kind of ties it all together.
It kind of changes everything.
Wow. Well, just real quick, you guys are in Crown Heights. And I know you've been based in Williamsburg. How does that feel different, and how is the neighborhood responding to that, and just kind of like any surprises?
It's a good question. Like when we were looking for scouting out where we should do this, we wanted to do Brooklyn. Like we didn't want to like do
Manhattan. Your Brooklyn winery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was more like, okay, where in Brooklyn? And we didn't start originally looking at Crown Heights. And you have to realize we looked, this has been like several years in the making. So we were thinking through this idea back in like 2013, I think. And we actually started more established neighborhoods like Cobble Hill, Brooklyn Heights, Dumbo. And like we looked very seriously at some spaces in those neighborhoods and just never got the full vibe. We just felt we would be another space on like Smith Street or Court Street or whatever. And we're like, let's go into a neighborhood that has just great passion, people are moving in, has just a lot of great energy, and let's be like the focal point in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
And when we started looking into Crown Heights, you can judge a neighborhood a lot by subway access. So the Franklin Avenue stop has the 2, the 3, the 4, and the 5 subways. It has amazing access, so it allows this neighborhood to start developing more quickly.
Well, there's also the A and the C.
And the A and C, which are only a few blocks away.
That's my train.
Right. So you have this great subway access. It's very close to the park, which also is appealing to people. And Prospect Park, that is. My favorite park. And then you have this street, Franklin Avenue, is kind of the one that we viewed as really kind of developing first of kind of the main avenues in the neighborhood. And it's already starting to have some good places that are developing followings. But I did see that there was definitely an opportunity to bring in something with a little bit finer dining. Not saying refined dining, but something that's a little bit more refined with a high level of service where you come in and you are taken care of, and also adding great wine to the block, which I thought the block needed a little bit more added for.
The block needed it. And
the block needed wine.
I'm really glad you're there.
Yes.
As a Crown Heights resident,
there's lots
I'm
of beer
thrilled.
In the block. We needed to add wine, and we also have a great cocktail program as well that we've added.
And brunch is coming soon.
Brunch is coming very, very soon.
Yay! This is all wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank
We're
you.
So thrilled you're in the neighborhood. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with the morning after quiz.
Sweet.
We're back with The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I'm having so much fun with my guest today, Brian Leventhal of Brooklyn Winery and BKW, the new restaurant by Brooklyn Winery. But we're about to take a big, serious turn because, Brian, it is time for The Morning After quiz.
I've been dreading this.
Yeah, I'm sure. That was awesome, David. I liked it. All right, this is actually not your first time. This is your second time.
I don't
time.
Remember. I don't think I did as well on the first one. We'll see.
As well as you
as I would have liked.
Planning
I'm
on trying doing this
to,
time?
We should have looked at my score from the first one, but whatever it was, I'm going to try to beat.
Okay, well, I think that you're gonna beat it no matter what.
Thank God. That's a lot of pressure.
So I don't know if you recall, but there's three questions.
Mm-hmm.
Each question has three possibilities, A, B, or C. It's multiple choice, and you'll try to guess the correct answer.
All right.
So this time, the morning after quiz is based on your first name, which is Brian. But instead of it being Brian Leventhal, this quiz is actually based on Brian Wilson, who is a member of the Beach Boys. So don't know how much you know about Brian Wilson.
Minimal knowledge. I know a few Beach Boys songs, but I'll give it my best.
That might help out. All right. Well, here it goes. First question. Brian Wilson's father, Murray, who was also the manager of the band, he was known to be emotionally and physically abusive to his son, Brian, and his other children. What was one of the things that he did to torture Brian and his kids? Was it A, he would take out his glass eye and force his children to peer into its empty socket? Was it B, he would force Brian to wear a dress and serve tea to his sister? Or was it C, he would lock him in a basement and feed him nothing but hard-boiled eggs for 48 hours?
So before I answer,
okay,
the fact that you came up with the other two responses that you wrote is very creative.
Thank you. I had to look deep into the dark part of my soul to come up with those.
All right, I'm taking a guess.
Okay.
And I'm going to do B, the dress.
Yeah, that was not actually it. Oh. Although that would have been really
one. Which one was
it? It's actually the creepiest one. It's
the eyeball one?
Yes.
All right,
he would take out
his
glass eye and force his children to look into the empty socket of his eye.
That's pretty deranged.
When he wanted to punish them. It is really, really, really gross. All right, here's a later one. What was the original name of the Beach Boys? Was it A, the Surfers? Was it B, the Summertime Guys? Or C, the Pendletones?
The Pendletones. I am embarrassed. I don't know much about the Beach Boys. I'm going to give it another good guess. I'm going to go with the Pendletones.
That's right. So I learned this too. Pendletones are actually the name of the wool shirts worn by surfers.
Cool.
Well, no, Pendleton. So they changed it from Pendleton to Pendletones, like tonal.
Were they surfers? I'm assuming they were.
I mean, their whole thing is like summertime.
Everybody goes surfing.
Oh, see, we know so many Beach Boys songs.
great early rock and roll pun at work.
There you go. Yes. Okay. And for the last question, you're one for two
so far.
I'm not
50%.
Yeah.
Baseball, that's great.
Yes, it is. Okay, so last one. The song Good Vibrations, which is a Beach Boys song, was inspired by A, an acid trip that Wilson had where he believed he had become Native American and stayed inside a DIY teepee for an entire day. Mm-hmm. B, a minor earthquake that Brian felt while listening to Phil Spector, whose music he was obsessed with. Or C, an exchange that Wilson had with his mother about how dogs can sense if a person is going to be friendly to them or not. Hence, like, they feel people's vibrations.
I'm going with the acid trip.
An acid trip. It's not the acid trip.
That would have been a fun answer.
Yeah, it seems like that would definitely be. But it was actually the conversation he had with his mother about whether or not dogs could sense a human based on like them having positive or negative vibrations.
Gotcha. One out of three.
One out of three ain't bad, man. That's like,
I think last time was about what did we do? Life of Brian.
We did the Life of Brian movie. Yeah. Yeah. I know. It was like hard to find.
I gotta get better with
people
that have my name, I guess.
Next time.
Yeah,
or maybe next time we'll mix it up.
Next time.
I know, like, there's not a lot of like interesting Leventhal. I found a couple of weird ones, but there wasn't anything really funny.
There was a former like news reporter, Rick Leventhal on NBC. That's the extent of it.
Oh, yeah. No, we can. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, you did pretty well. You got one, which is more than a whole lot of people. A whole heck of a lot of people. Brian, thank you so much for coming. It was a pleasure to have you again. We're very excited about BKW. It's all sounding so delicious.
Thank you so much. And yeah, come check it out.
Absolutely. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back here next week, Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.